This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. As a young person, Ernest Hemingway spent many summers in northern Michigan, and much of his writing reflects on his time among the waters and forests near Petoskey. He chose up north to recuperate after being wounded in World War I, and he started his career as a writer of fiction there. It was the scene of his first wedding. The new documentary by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, titled Hemingway, premiered this week on PBS. And here to talk more with us about Hemingway's Michigan roots is Christopher Strubel. He's president of the Michigan Hemingway Society. Christopher, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's quite an honor.
Will you paint a picture for us of the area where Hemingway spent his summers?
Yeah, it's kind of just like it is now. We have these beautiful lakes that were carved out when the glaciers retreated 10,000 years ago, all this fresh water. And that was a boom for tourism in the 1890s. Lumbering had pretty much cleared the whole area, and they were looking for a way to revitalize the area, and tourism was the way. And they sent out a lot of promo stuff to Kansas City, Chicago, and St. Louis. And, of course, the Hemingways were one of those families that came from the suburbs of Chicago, Illinois, and found their way up here the first time in 1898. Dr. Clarence Hemingway and his wife, Grace, who was an opera singer who actually made a little bit more money than her husband did, they rode the lake that morning before they headed out, and they found a beautiful piece of land that was 375 feet long, beautiful sloping sandy beach. They had a child and then one on the way, and they wanted to make sure when they returned the next summer in 1899, Hemingway's first year up here, that they had a nice, safe beach. Dr. Clarence Hemingway was always concerned about the children drowning over the years, so he picked what I would consider probably the best beach on all of Walloon. They paid around $250 for 375 feet. If you were to compare that to today's average, it's about $14,000 a foot out there when you have parcels of 100 feet or more. So pretty good investment.
My gosh. Do folks who are in the area and who've lived there a long time, do you run into folks who remember Hemingway today?
You know, we do. He's 123 years old, so it's this summer would be 122, so 123rd year he would have been up here. But we still have a few people that remember him or remembering him, you know, so these memories get a little convoluted a little bit. Ernest Mainland, who was his nephew, he just passed away this year, and he was one of the only family members that actually are still alive that met Hemingway. But he often said that he's not sure if his memories were his own or memories that he heard afterwards, you know, from his mother. And then we had a local legend here, Irene Gordon. So in the time that I've lived in northern Michigan, Irene Gordon and Judge Ned Fenlon both lived to be collectively like 107 years old. So I've heard Ned Fenlon say that damn Hemingway stole my girlfriend from me. Must be something in the water up here as far as longevity.
Yeah. You have said that it's hard to find a Hemingway story that doesn't mention Michigan to some degree. Let's start with one that's actually titled Up in Michigan.
Yeah, great one.
Yeah, this was perhaps one of his more controversial, especially for its time.
That's saying something for Hemingway, right? One of his most controversial.
Right. Where did it take place?
It, you know, I was talking with the owners last night. It took place in Horton Bay at the Dilworth Cottage. And the Dilworth Cottage is comprised of Shangri-La and Pinehurst. And they served chicken dinners there. It was one of the more well-known resort communities in northern Michigan. And it was just three houses kind of combined there. The houses are still almost exactly as they were during Hemingway's time. Shangri-La is actually for rent. It's a summer rental. And it's one of those places where you can really experience Hemingway. It's one of those rare opportunities to sit there and read Hemingway in a house where Hemingway would have sat while he was thinking about writing Hemingway. It's a really, really unique locale. Very much preserved the way it was. There's a lot of wetlands there. And so just by happenstance, some of these areas have been preserved with no connection to Hemingway just because of the way things happened. So it's really cool how authentic the area is up here to this day.
Let's listen to a clip from the Ken Burns and Lynn Novick documentary titled Hemingway.
I think Up in Michigan is very important because, first of all, he is saying there are no boundaries. I'm going to write with no boundaries, no restrictions. I'm not going to listen to you, polite world. I'm going to what I think is true, but I'm going to see it from the point of view of the woman.
Liz Coates is a teenaged girl working in a boarding house in the tiny town of Horton's Bay. Among the boarders is a handsome young blacksmith named Jim Gilmore. One evening, they go down to the dock.
"Don't, Jim," Liz said. Jim slid the hand further up. "You mustn't, Jim. You mustn't." Neither Jim nor Jim's big hand paid any attention to her.
The story concerns Jim Gilmore, a blacksmith who comes to Horton's Bay, and Liz Coates, a young woman who's got a crush on him. At risk of giving away the plot of the story, there's a rape involved. And there are a real Jim and Liz, I understand, who were in fact very dear family friends and had cottages where Hemingway would stay. Do you have any idea of how folks in the area reacted to that story, or, you know, sort of the mores that were reflected in it?
Yes. I mean, for its time, Gertrude Stein said this story is unpublishable, even in that time. And of course, now with the cancel culture, who knows, you know, how that would be perceived. But, you know, we kind of try to take things in context of when it was written. But even at that time, it was still controversial. Jim and Liz were great family friends of the Hemingways. And it's interesting that Hemingway often wrote in several stories that it wasn't time to talk about these things because these people were still alive. But yet, in Up in Michigan, which was first written in 1921, the same year he would have stayed there for his wedding, he chose to use Jim and Liz by their first name. And in the original copy, he actually had the Dilworth's name written there, but he penciled that out and then changed it to Gilmore. So he really was, you know, incorporating them into the story. But that was part of his whole writing technique, was to write what you really know. And those early sketches that were so great were really things that he had experienced throughout his life. Now, of course, this scenario that happens in the story, again, without giving out the plot, it never took place. They were already a married, established couple by the time Hemingway met them, and he called them Uncle Jim and Aunt Liz. And when the story came out, there was quite a bit of controversy, not so much locally, but more internationally. And then, of course, this was the first of two big fallouts that happened in that summer with his parents. When his mother read the story, she couldn't believe that he had incorporated the names, and his sister Marceline felt the same way. You know, these were family friends, and to put them in that scenario was kind of a little bit, just maybe a little bit taboo.
Did Ernest Hemingway ever say why he did that?
You know, he didn't, and it kind of goes back to another story that involves Marge Bump. And we're talking with Marge, and that was another kind of a controversial story about a breakup of a relationship that never happened. And Marge, her son's 91 years old. He's one of those people that still remembers meeting Hemingway. And Hemingway made a visit to their house in Florida in the 50s. And the, you know, the talk of the table that evening was, why did you use my real name? And he was always usually very particular about not really, you know, divulging who the actual person was. He would change names around a little bit, but yet here Marge Bump shows up as Marge Bump. As Sid remembers, Hemingway proceeded to drink all the gin in the house, and then they settled the score and everything was fine. But for some reason, in those two stories, he chose to use actual people, even though he was very sensitive about the fact that could be a little bit off limits. Hmm. And, but, you know, Jim and Liz, they kind of responded with a laugh. Here, he's a blacksmith, the real Jim, and the real Liz, and she serves chicken dinners at the Dilworth Cottage. And all of a sudden, here they are in the center of a international kind of controversy, a literary controversy, and they thought it was a little bit humorous, actually.
Jeez. There are other stories. Summer People from the Nick Adams series, and also Wedding Day. And Northern Michigan was the site of the actual wedding luncheon for Hemingway and his bride at the time, Hadley Richardson. Do you have a favorite Michigan-specific story in the canon?
Yeah, and you just mentioned it, and it's actually probably the first time that Nick Adams appears in fiction, and that's Summer People. That's one of my favorite stories, and it just really captures that freedom that he always talked about in Northern Michigan. You know, he came from a kind of a strict and regimented upbringing, so much in Oak Park to a certain extent. But when they came up here to Northern Michigan, it was kind of, you know, everything was open as far as skinny dipping in the lake and a little bit of extra freedom. It's dark and kids get to do what kids do after dark. And to me, that's just sort of the quintessential summer story. And if you were to kind of really analyze The Sun Also Rises and compare it to Summer People, you'll see so many similarities between those stories, in my opinion. And it was just the first one that really caught my attention. And it's probably one of my all-time favorite stories, right behind The Sun Also Rises, coincidentally. Yeah, so Summer People would be my favorite Nick Adams story and Michigan sketch. And when you walk down that beach and that stretch of road today, it's just like it was at that time.
If you're just joining us, we're talking today with president of the Michigan Hemingway Society, Christopher Struble. He's giving us sort of a verbal tour through some of the favorite woods and forests that Ernest Hemingway visited and enjoyed up north. I'm inferring from something you said earlier that the Hemingway cottage has never left the family?
No, it went to Hemingway after his father committed suicide, unfortunately, in 1928. Hemingway officially took ownership in 1935. Even though it was deeded to him, or unofficially deeded to him, at the passing of Clarence. And then when Hemingway passed away, it laid in limbo for a little while longer until his sister Sonny took over the cottage, and she lived there until her passing. And then it transferred to her only son, who was Hemingway's namesake, Ernest Miller Hemingway Mainland, who just recently passed away, unfortunately, a few months ago. So it's still in the family, and just kind of wondering what's going to happen in the next generation.
Is there any clarity about the estate at this point?
No, it's just a little too soon to sort of make these inquisitions, and so we're just or inquiries. I'm sorry, but we're just kind of waiting to see what's going to happen.
Yeah, what would you like to see happen with it?
You know, at one time I thought it was really going to transfer to one of the major universities in the country, and there was a little bit of scandal involved with that university, and I was kind of maybe sidestep that a little bit. But I'd love to see it preserved in a way that could be shared by the scholars and the fans of Hemingway, and still maybe remain in possession of the family to a certain extent also. Kind of looking for the perfect balance would be my preference. It's just such an honor when you get a chance to go in there. And over the last 3-4 decades, it's not uncommon to have people show up out front. And of course, everybody wants to see this, that's a Hemingway fan. But looking at it from the point of the former owner, Ernie Mainland, one time he was in the shower and he remembers hearing people in the living room. He came out and here's this group of tourists in his front living room. So it's on the state of historic, or it's on the list of historical residences in the United States, but it's still a private residence.
Wait, they just walked in?
They just walked in. And when he told them they had to leave, they said, well, we're going to talk to the neighbors about this. Kind of.
Is the cottage, as Ernie Mainland maintained it, has it changed very much from the days when Ernest Hemingway spent time there?
No, but that's not without some tender, loving care. In 1997, I want to say, they started some major renovations. The place sat pretty much vacant for, probably the better part of 20 years, maybe even a little longer. And as places in northern Michigan, this happens in a nice, moist, wet environment with heavy winters. The cottage suffered quite a bit of internal damage and some stuff with the foundation. And they started a very comprehensive renovation process in the 1997 period, which was finished by the time of 1999, which was the centennial of Hemingway's birth. And that's when I first toured the cottage. But they painstakingly really took great care to maintain all the integrity of the cottage. And there's traces of him throughout the cottage. That there's no doubt about that.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, so when Hemingway was wounded in World War I, one of the things that he was known for was he was a bit superstitious, and he always wore a good luck charm. And that fateful day, he had a Oak Park track medal on his chest. He was wearing on a chain as a good luck charm, and that piece suffered quite a bit of damage from a piece of shrapnel that would have been a fatal wound to the chest. And they have that framed, and it's in the cottage right next to the windowsill where he used to sleep. There's little marks around the house where Clarence had stopped doors from swinging because the cottage was slightly off level. I'd say all in all, when you're inside the cottage, you're looking at about 90% authenticity of the time of Hemingway's time in the cottage, right down to the thing that caught me the most. And I really appreciated this because in my childhood, we did the same as many people do in their cottages. There's a board next to the door, and it shows all the family members at different heights throughout the summers that they spent there. And that's preserved as it was. And Hemingway's final marker was probably about 6'1".
You take people on walking tours of people come from all over the world, really, to come see the waters and the forests that Hemingway loved and that he wrote about. Christopher, has the land changed very much in all these years?
So we have places that obviously have changed, but when you get out to Horton Bay for the Nick Adams tour, which is a more extensive tour that we do, it's probably like a 2.5 hour tour where we go out to Hemingway country. Really, the only thing that's changed out there is the trees are a little bit taller. You know, the lumbering years did quite a bit of damage up here. And when Hemingway was here, it was kind of that second growth kind of coming up. And the one thing we say now is we pretty much have the authentic setting in the woods, but the trees are a little bit taller. Now, in 1905, his mother purchased a big piece of property on the opposite side of the land, of the lake, and it was about 1,700 feet of property, again, for a really good value. And it was a 40-acre farm, and she ultimately built her own cottage over there. The cottage still stands, but Longfield Farm, which is what they called the farm at that time, that's pretty much a mega million mansions, you know, cottages, these amazing summer cottages there. So that piece of property has very much been developed. But just to the west of that is Camp Michigania, the University of Michigan's retreat, summer retreat. And they've accumulated a lot of that Hemingway farm property. So that's all pristine and preserved the way it was during Hemingway's time.
Hmm. Is there a favorite place that you go to when you need a little time away?
Yeah, and that's the nice thing is you can slip out of town here and you can hit Horton Bay. And within 15 minutes of leaving downtown Petoskey, you can find yourself at the Nick Adams Preserve. Walk down to Horton Creek and you can really experience that setting that he would have loved. Pretty much what he captures in the big two-hearted river, the same essence is right there in Horton Bay as we speak. And then if I'm really lucky and really fortunate, I spend a couple, 3 or 4 days in Shangri-La, one of the Dilworth's cottages, and read Hemingway while I'm sitting on the couch next to the stairway that he sneaks up after his liaison in Summer People.
Christopher Struble is president of the Michigan Hemingway Society. Christopher, thanks so much for telling us a little bit more about these areas and what makes them special.
Well, thank you for having me. And again, this is my passion up here. And when it comes to Hemingway, I appreciate Cuba and Spain and Paris and all the places he's known to have spent so much time. But it was those 23 consecutive years that he spent here in Northern Michigan that I think really shaped not only his writing, but really had a major influence on his personal life also.